Hey guys, first of all, welcome back to the podcast. I know we've had a couple hiccups here and there. I want to start this off with an apology. We were actually going to be dropping Chobra's podcast a couple days, I guess about a week from when this has been dropped, and we actually had Kolaris's in the tank to come out later. I want to apologize to everybody, especially Chobra and Kolaris. We fucked up over here. We do not have the recordings anymore. This has been a real learning experience for me, just trying to start this thing and be in charge of the files and everything like that. I didn't realize how easy it was to lose something like this. So we're not going to have that. I've already apologized to those guys personally. I feel really bad about it. And I also feel bad for you guys because these were really good episodes. But unfortunately, it's just gone, man. This is like, you know, when the Library of Alexandria burned down? That's like this, but for two podcasts. So we're never going to get them back. It sucks. But I think I've learned from this, and it's not going to happen again. So sorry about that. I fucked up. I take full responsibility. But we do have a lot of other guests coming up here, and I'm sure I'll be able to get Chobra and Kolaris again in the future. This podcast is the AMA edition because you beautiful people are continuing to support me. Thank you so much. You guys sent in a lot of great questions. What we try to do is parse through a lot of them because some of them were repeat questions and try to space them out or I guess categorize them. So I don't know. These were really nice stuff that you guys sent in. Also, you guys sent in a lot of just nice messages in general. I did my best to try to answer these as honestly as I could. We try to do it basically in just one take. So it's me talking off the top of my head. And, you know, I'm always open to do one of these things again. Of course, this would not have happened if you guys had not supported me on Patreon. For those of you guys who might be listening to this for the first time, if you can support us on Patreon, I guess, you know, I don't stream on Twitch right now, but imagine it like it's a Twitch sub, okay? If you're supporting us on Patreon, it really goes a long way. It's the best way to directly support me. So if you want to support us, if you have some extra cash, it's appreciated. Go to patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. And I guess that does it. Let's go ahead and jump into the recording of me doing this AMA. All right. First question. How different would an unrated version of the GSL be? So I guess, first of all, I got to point out, we actually are not rated at all. We don't really have anybody who's telling us like what to say or what to do. Basically, Afrika TV is giving Artosis and me total freedom. I mean, they know we're not going to do something totally insane or stupid. But, you know, for instance, we're allowed to curse. We're allowed to, as you guys have already seen, you know, joke about other stuff, make fun of each other. So we've actually experimented with cursing before in some of our casts. I think some people have clipped that in the past. We messed around with it to see if it would sound better and more authentic, and we kind of backed away from it. I mean, we could still do it, but yeah, I mean, to be honest, there's no moment where we say something and one of us gets in trouble, or people are coming downstairs and trying to edit us or change what we're saying. You'll see a lot more of that at overseas tournaments. But basically, you know, Afrika TV really trusts Dan and me. They kind of give us total control, and you know, the show we're putting on is basically, you know, the kind of show that I think we want to watch, which is what we're going for. You know, we don't want to be too vulgar or, you know, make too many, I guess, sexual jokes or anything like that, just because, I mean, at the end of the day, people are there to watch StarCraft games. So we're trying to get the biggest, best audience possible. But, you know, if it was to be Artosis and me just doing a show where we talked about whatever, I think it would probably be a lot more vulgar. we curse a lot in real life. But, I mean, to be frank, I think, I don't know. I think we've got a good balance at GSL. I'm happy with where it is. But, and I mean, an unrated version of us, you know, kind of being ourselves, I think that it would probably be a little bit more R-rated. okay. Next question. What do you think of interviewing Korean pros on your podcast? Who would be some of the most interesting Korean guests? Would it work going through a translator? So for now, I don't have any plans. I'm not against the idea, but I don't have any plans of trying to get pros on and have it done through a translator. I think for one, I don't think I'm really ready yet. Two, I'm not sure if having a podcast in two languages is the feel I'm going for right now. I think I'm still getting the hang of interviewing, whether it's pros or esports personalities or whoever I'm going to be interviewing. I'm still kind of getting the hang of doing that in a conversational format. And I think trying to do this with a translator there and for me to get the feel that I want to get out of it, I don't know that I would be happy with what I would be putting out. I also feel like there's a lot of translated interviews with pros that are out there. I don't think all of them are the best ones. And I think most of those translated ones I'm talking about are the written down, like written down translated interviews. Like they interview a Korean pro, Korean news outlet interviews Korean pro, and then it's translated on Team Liquid. So I think some of that stuff's out there. But for now, again, I'm not against it, but I think it would be a while before I would be trying something like that. The next question is, why have you preferred to do pre-recorded conversations over something live? I think it's a good question. For one, I think we're able to make a better product, at least for now. We're able to edit it. As far as like the sound quality, also a lot of the people that I'm getting on this show, a lot of people like this are sometimes wary about doing interviews because they don't want to slip up and say the wrong thing. And, you know, it might affect their work, or the reputation. So when I'm interviewing people, and granted, there's been virtually no editing out of anything. When I bring someone on, they're comfortable being here because I'm making sure that, you know, they're in a safe spot where they can talk about anything. And if they said something they regretted, we can be like, okay, look, we don't have to put that in there if you don't want to. Also, I feel like it's sort of the nature of Twitch and especially online gaming, but everything is a live stream. And I'm not against, for instance, having recordings of the show thrown up on Twitch or like the moment that we get done with it, you can listen to the recording live on Twitch. I'm not really against that. But for now, I feel like it's a little bit better to do it this way. Also, there's not a lot of good gaming podcasts out there. And so to be candid, I'm kind of experimenting with a space that I think is really being underutilized. I think especially in gaming and esports, there's so much of everybody imitating each other that I don't really feel the need to try to follow that direction. Now, maybe down the road, and this would be down the road, okay, but maybe I can have certain episodes that would be live streamed or have a kind of a permutation of this show, where assuming that I can eventually get some more mics here, where we can do something live. But at least for what you guys are listening to now, I'm trying to make something really clean that sounds really good, something you can listen to in your car or when you're walking your dog or when you're playing a game. And so that's sort of the angle that I'm going for here. And I know that it can be frustrating because everything else is on Twitch. I think down the road we'll probably be uploading stuff. But for now, just the way the show is being constructed, I prefer the recorded section. Also, keep in mind that everybody in esports is on different time zones, right? So it's kind of hard to get a live interview, first of all. The recordings are all face-to-face, right? So they come over to my house, we sit down, we talk. It's a lot easier to conduct an interview like that. But just to get times when it works for everybody, with the amount that I'm casting with StarCraft 1 and StarCraft 2, the travel that I have in between that, it's just easier if we can get a time where it works for everybody. And then later on, we can get it edited and recorded and cleaned up and put out the best possible thing. So that's why we're doing it like this. Okay, next question. I'll just read this one directly. It says, quote, behind the scenes, quote, Patreon tier more affordable, question mark. I don't care for public recognition, aka your name in the credits, but I would be interested in seeing something behind the scenes. I've seen some of the behind the scenes pictures at a more reasonable price, like maybe $10. I'm actually fine with that. You know, when we started the Patreon and got that set up, I sort of didn't know what I was doing. sort of just throwing numbers around and kind of trying to see what sticks. But I think very soon here we're going to be restructuring this a little bit. So, yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that. I totally am interested in feedback like that. So expect some changes here in the future. I am from Switzerland, and the StarCraft scene here is very small and has been since the launch in 2010. Any idea why some countries are producing much more high-level players than similar ones? So I think there's a lot to unpack with this. Okay, so you're in Switzerland. Switzerland is known for its mountains. It's outdoor activities. So a lot of times, if you look at regions of the world, you have to ask yourself what else is going on hobby-wise that people can partake in. There's not a lot of professional gamers that come from beach cities, for instance. You know, they could be surfing or snorkeling or doing whatever. For instance, I grew up in Kansas City. I spent most of my life, my young life, in Kansas City. And there were actually a lot of really good players for a lot of different games in KC. So we had a couple arcades. There were a lot of good fighting game players. There were a lot of little tournaments. There were several great Counter-Strike players. Besides my brother and me, there was actually a handful of very solid StarCraft players. And we even had Fatality. I think some of you guys might be too young to remember who that was, but he was like 30 minutes from my house. And he was the world Quake champion back when Quake was like a really, really, really big deal. So I went from that environment. And by the way, Kansas City is not known for very much. It's not a terrible place, but it's not known, for instance, for where I went to university at, which was Denver, Colorado. And once I got to Denver, I realized that everybody here sucked at games. There were some people that liked to play games, but nobody was that competitive. Any game I picked up in my small school, I was either the best or close to the best at. And I think a lot of that's just because there was more stuff to do in Denver. So it might be that if you're in Switzerland, it's just more of an outdoorsy place. I mean, if you look at like Sweden, for instance, which has very great players, Sweden is like a frozen suburb for most of the year. I mean, it's a wonderful place, but there definitely is a need for what to do with your time, right? I mean, most of Sweden is a giant frozen forest. So it's not surprising that you have people that pick up games and get competitive. For instance, South Korea, where this podcast is getting recorded at, most of the time in South Korea, the weather is pretty brutal. It's either way too hot or way too cold. It's also an Asian megacity, so there's not that much vegetation to play in. Koreans, they pick up hobbies that are more indoor-oriented. They're very into dancing. They're into singing. And, of course, they're into gaming. So I think some of this stuff comes down to what your ecosystem is. And I think I've talked about this a little bit in other podcasts, but, I mean, let's kind of expand on that. Like, why are Smash Brothers players, a lot of them from the United States, I believe there's a decent number of good ones from Canada, and the Nordic region of the world. Well, part of that's because those, first of all, Smash being a console game, the people that got to practice that, they had to go to people's houses, right? So you had to have cultures where you would go to somebody else's house. For instance, in South Korea, you don't normally go to somebody's house. Usually everybody's in these kind of tiny box apartments. So it's not really conducive to making good Smash players out here. I mean, there's other reasons why, you know, Nintendo games aren't as big out here as well. But basically, in the United States, I mean, for me, and I think this is true for most of the people who are Americans that are listening to this, especially when you're young and you don't have a lot of money, you're going to your friend's house or your friends are coming to your house. Whether you're a little kid and you're going to your friend's parents' house or you're in college or you're a young adult and you have roommates. And so because of that, you see better gamers come out of that. So I think that's a big part of it. I do feel like as gaming gets more and more ubiquitous everywhere, we're going to see more great players coming out of more rare locations, or I guess unexpected locations. But again, if you just go back to a lot of just kind of location and opportunity, you'll kind of see this. I mean, even in the Philippines, for instance, PC cafes are everywhere. And it's a good way to spend your time out there, especially in extreme heat. So there's a lot of great Dota players in the Philippines. So that would be my input for why some places have better gamers than others. There's also cultural reasons for that, but generally you want to have an environment where gaming is A, encouraged, and B, other options might be more limited, and I think that's where you tend to see stronger scenes. But then again, it does not mean you can't become a great player no matter where you are in the world, as long as you have fairly decent internet. The next question asks, especially in the earlier years, did the stress of being in a career field without, quote, job security, unquote, ever get to you? If so, how did you overcome this and move forward? This never really stressed me. I don't know if that's because I was crazy when I was younger. The big leap was for me when I was, I want to say 22 or 23 and moved to Seoul. Because before that, I mean, it was just like I was going to a random tournament here or there and, you know, bombing out of a couple classes. So I didn't view it as I definitely thought there actually was a future in this. Just after you get to enough of these convention halls and you see all these people working and all these different jobs, I thought, okay, there's something here. Here's the thing. Because I get asked this question actually a decent amount, and I think people look at, for instance, esports casting as more obtuse than it really is. I mean, really, I'm just a broadcaster, right? So, and I'm working in television. I mean, I know it's not necessarily on what you turn your TV on and see, but it's the same idea, right? So, I mean, I have experience now where I could go into radio, I could go into news broadcasting, I could go into other forms of TV hosting, I could go into TV production, I could go into game development. There's just so many kind of commonplace jobs that this could filter into. Not that I necessarily say I would try to get a more basic job if this didn't work out, but I think that it's important to realize that this really isn't that crazy, and it's also it's a hard job too. So I mean, it teaches you a good work ethic. You got to try to stay up to date with stuff as much as possible. Also, you know, I don't feel like, and maybe this is because I'm from the States, I don't feel like there's a lot of job security anywhere from where I'm from. A lot of Americans, you know, I think it's like half of Americans have under $400 in the bank. In other words, if they were in an emergency, they would be totally fucked. So, I mean, for me, if there was risk involved, I was absolutely willing to take it. And keep in mind, like, I was pretty young when I came out here. I was 23 or 22. I can't remember. But, I mean, there was always the option to go back to school. And so, also, you know, I really want to do something I like. I mean, we're all going to die one day, and I would like to do something that's fun and cool and something I actually like doing over, I guess, taking a more conservative path. So, I mean, I'm happy with my decision. But that particular thing I don't think stressed me out as much. The job security. I was more obsessed because it took me about 3 years to get GSL. Before that, I was doing a whole bunch of other shows and pitching other shows and doing a lot of freelance work. But my larger stress was getting zoned out of Korea before StarCraft II was out, because I was confident when StarCraft II came out, I was perfectly positioned to take over an important casting role and then cement my future. So that was my bigger concern, was just trying to make ends meet until StarCraft II came out, because StarCraft I casting at the time was much more unstable out here, in English, I mean. Now, funnily enough, now it's also StarCraft I casting in English is quite stable. But if that answers that question, I hope that answers that question. Basically, I was much more stressed out with trying to make it work here. And now that I've done that, I mean, I've had GSL for over 8 years now. So things are going good. This question asks, with the change in studios, is it possible for a visitor to say hi to the players the way we could in the old GOM studio? So this is from somebody who definitely has been watching for a long time. So originally, we were in, this is back when GSL was owned by a company called GOM TV, which was basically a video player company, like I guess what you'd refer to like VLC as. Do people still use VLC? Okay, yeah. Is there any other major one? Don't think so. Okay, so basically it was Korean VLC. And their business model was to I am going to answer this, but I'm just for the background of the people that don't understand where this question is coming from. So the GOM player, they wanted to try to move into content creation. So they bought this small studio that was on top of a middle school in a cheaper area of Seoul called Mukdong. And that was a very tiny studio. I think the production did an excellent job making it look bigger than it was, but it was very intimate. And eventually, we upgraded to a baller-ass studio in Samsung, which we're still at now. And so I think this person who's asking this question was coming to the studio in the earlier days and is now wondering, okay, how do things operate in this new studio? It's basically the same. I mean, you can interact with the players. I mean, as long as you're not bothering them or anything like that. I mean, they're usually happy to meet fans. The only thing that is, I think, quite different is that I am on a balcony, as are the Korean casters, in, I'd say, about 80% of the broadcasts. Occasionally, they put us out on the stage floor, but usually they're trying to use... this studio is about 4 or 5 times bigger, by the way. It's much, much bigger. I think it holds a couple hundred people. I want to say like 400 to 500. I have to double check, but it fills up. It gets quite packed. So it's basically impossible to interact with Artosis and me or the Korean casters until the show's done. So if you want to say hi to us right when the English broadcast ends, there's a little door. You'll see the players go in and out of it. It's where the makeup room is. That's how Artosis and me head out as well. There's a few trash cans by there too, but we're always happy to say hi. So yeah, I mean, if you want to come by or get a photo with us or get us to sign something, absolutely feel free to do so. It's just a little bit harder because of getting up and down the balconies to really interact with us beyond that. But I would definitely come down. I think you'd be impressed how nice the studio is, especially considering where we started. And now the Afrika, it was the GOM TV production staff. We were all bought by Afrika TV. But they're producing all sorts of stuff. I mean, the PUBG stuff they're putting on is pretty crazy as well. So I think everybody's come a long way. Okay, I like this question. Name one person that you would have dinner with and most importantly, why that person? I'm going to say Marilyn Manson. I would love to have dinner with Marilyn Manson. I grew up listening to his music. I guess the end of high school, early parts of college. But I thought he was just such a excellent musician. I thought he was so creative. There's only been one of them, right? I mean, there's nobody that quite comes close to what he did. And he was sort of the last era of that, I guess, type of rock music. I don't know. I think he's just such an interesting character. I guess some people were probably expecting me to say, like, I don't know, like Abraham Lincoln or something, or some pro gamer or... But if I had a choice, I'd love to sit down and hang out with that guy. I think he's a really unique person, and he gave me a lot of inspiration to kind of be myself when I was younger. So I would say him. Okay, here's one I get a lot. When is Artosis going to be on the podcast? He'll eventually be on. Right now, what we're trying to do is, since all these interviews are done face-to-face, I'm trying to prioritize people who are in the country for a limited amount of time, so I can grab them, interview them, and then as they are leaving, you know, I guess send them on their way. Artosis is always going to be here. I mean, we're always going to be doing GSL, or obviously, for as long as we can. So I've just been sort of saving him, you know. I also felt like if I brought him on immediately, it would lead to some confusion as to why is Artosis not always on this show. I'm sure people would love to hear us have a conversation. There's also a lot of us already doing that on GSL and ASL. So for now, we're still mapping out how to do this podcast, but I've just been sort of keeping him on the back burner here. You know, one thing, I know that you guys always see Artosis and me together, and I think some of you guys probably think we like ride a tandem bike home together and sleep in bunk beds, but he actually lives an hour and a half away from me. He lives in a suburb south of Seoul that's really good for raising a family. It's got good schools there, and the apartments are much bigger and more affordable. It's just a better family area to be in if you're in Korea and you're working out of Seoul. And I'm in the northwestern part of Seoul in kind of a hipster district. And it just sort of serves our needs a little bit better. So whenever we meet, we usually meet halfway somewhere in downtown in Seoul. But it would be a little bit, it would be quite a journey for him to come all the way down to my house and do this, or for me to go all the way to him and do this, or for us to find some spot to rent and set this equipment up. So there's that as well. So, I mean, he's going to be on at some point in time, but we've both been really busy and we're kind of in no rush. You know, another question I was getting asked a lot is, why were you not on the Pylon show? And it, kind of a similar thing, but this time not with distance, just with time. You know, that was recorded early in the morning. And I just am not much of a morning person. I think I'm like a lot of the North American viewers that watch GSL. I'm up in the middle of the night doing stuff, bumping around my house. And I tend to sleep in kind of late. So it just didn't quite work for me. And then, of course, I'm busy doing, you know, the shows I'm doing and stuff like this podcast. So I hope that answers the question. He'll be on eventually, I'm sure. For now, we just don't know when. Okay, this person asks, I definitely want to visit Seoul and see some live StarCraft. All right. What are your favorite places to visit in and around Seoul? Anything you consider a can't miss for someone visiting? Okay, so first of all, Seoul is an excellent city. I've been very fortunate that I've gotten to travel around the world, and this is definitely one of the best cities I've ever been to. So I love living here. I know the people that come and visit here also are very impressed with it. So for favorite places to visit, there's a couple spots you should probably go to as far as doing the whole Asia mega city thing, right? I think Gangnam Station, you should just see. It's such a well-known location, and that's in the newer part of downtown, south of the Han River. Seoul is cut in half, by the way, by the Han River. So half of the city is north of that, half of the city is south of that. I think visiting the expatriate community is pretty cool. So heading down to Itaewon and kind of seeing this whole sort of thriving non-Korean part of Seoul is cool. It really shows how cosmopolitan Seoul's become. If you're young, I would recommend the Hongdae Shincheon area. There's lots of clubs and there's lots of live music outside, cheap food. Let me think here. I guess, you know, there's some ritzier areas like Apgujeong, which can be nice to go to. So for that, I would definitely say if you want to kind of just have a night out in the city and do stuff, I think those are places to go to. For landmarks, there are a handful of temples that are still intact, that are ancient, that you can check out. Some of them were destroyed during the Korean War. But definitely check out the temples. There's a really beautiful tower in the northern center of Seoul called Namsan Tower. And it's on top of a mountain, and you can take a cable car up there. I recommend you get there early because it's kind of a trek. And you can then go up into the tower, and there's a 360-degree view of Seoul. I recommend you go at night because then you can see the whole city lit up. And that will really give you an appreciation for just how fucking big this place is, because it's insane. I think the population of just Seoul proper is 11 million, but if you take the outer edge of it, it goes up to about 23 million. So just a huge city. Really cool stuff. You can take a boat ride on the Han River. That's very cheap. I don't know. I mean, you could just Google that basically and find that, but it's not. It's cool. You could hang out there. Again, the city is really beautiful at night. For stuff to do just around Korea in general, depending on the time of year, Busan, which is the major southern beach city here, is quite nice if you want to go to Hyundai Beach and just see all the lights there. There is Jeju Island. I thought that was pretty cool, but I wouldn't say you need to go to Jeju compared to the other islands that are around Asia. Keep in mind that, you know, for me personally, living in South Korea, you actually have access to a whole bunch of other crazy, interesting places, whether that be like beach places or, you know, I was just in Mongolia not long ago. There's, you know, you can get trips to Thailand. So there's a lot of cool places to check out. So I would say first check out Seoul, definitely. There's a bunch of really pretty stuff to do. I think there was a Netflix two-part thing that was exhibiting all the cool parts about South Korea that you could check out. I think if you Google that, you can probably find that. And that had a whole bunch of cool landmarks, and they would do a better job of explaining that than I would. As far as kind of stuff to do, I guess if you're listening to this podcast, it's definitely worth saying go to a PC cafe. They're a lot of fun. They're really cool. You'll really see why this place produces the best gamers. They're called Norebongs, but they're basically karaoke rooms. You can go there and sing music, and that's fun. Definitely get Korean barbecue. Try a lot of the Korean food. Gosh, I don't know. There's so much cool stuff. There's so much good food down here. There's so many things to do. Definitely come check it out. I would say you need at least a week here, maybe a little bit more. I'd say, 5 to 7 days in Seoul, and then if you want to have a week of going around. Oh, also, the whole country is connected by a high-speed railway system that's pretty easy to use. So, I mean, once you get into Korea, you can basically get anywhere, or you have a short plane ride to Jeju. I hope that is some good advice for you. This question asks, how big of a social change was it going from America to Korea? What was the biggest surprise? So, first of all, I'm a pretty traveled person before I came here. I was actually born outside of the States, and I traveled around with my folks a little bit, and I've had family abroad. So I think, also my dad has lived overseas for my entire life. So visiting him, I was always going to crazy different places. So I think I was probably more equipped to move here than most people. I also had one freelance job here for a week before I got offered a job to come out. That being said, I think visiting places is very different from living there. So I grew up in Kansas City. There you basically, if it's nighttime and two people are walking past each other, walking down the street, you say hi to each other to kind of diffuse tension. It took me a long time to understand that in a big Asian city like Seoul, nobody interacts with anybody at all, basically day or night. Like, it's just kind of considered aggressive and rude and weird. So that was a little bit tricky. Like, I'd get in the elevator for my apartment, and I thought I needed to, like, say something because we're going up, 25 floors. And I didn't realize you just don't have to say anything. But after I learned that, I got very comfortable with it. I kind of liked just sort of being in my own thoughts despite being completely surrounded by people constantly. Let me think here. Another one that I think was a surprise for me was the way that police are in Korea compared to American police. Being a young guy growing up in the States, you were always a little bit worried when a police car would drive by you, even if you weren't doing anything wrong. The American police are much more, I guess, militarized. I guess they have to be because of the number of guns that are there, and there's a higher crime rate. But, I mean, police in Korea are pretty innocuous, and you almost never see them. But they're also, the crime rate's much lower. Like, I could have one of my friends walk home or walk 30 minutes home in the middle of the night, like 2 a.m., and I know they wouldn't get robbed. That's rare for most other countries. So that was a shock to me to realize that there's a lot of other places that are just generally speaking more safer than where I grew up. Okay. Next question here. This is a little bit of a longer one. How is it being a Caucasian living in Korea? Do Koreans know who you are? And is it a factor in your personal life? Have you found personal hardship or joy while dating in Korea? Could you explain how it is to date a Korean as a white male? Hope this isn't too personal. No problem at all. I want to say about half my time in Korea, I have dated people who are not Koreans, and the other half of the time, I have dated Koreans. So I think the biggest factor, first of all, in Korea, Caucasian or not, is just being a foreigner. This is one of the most, homogenous countries ever. Korea was actually called the Hermit Kingdom for a long time because it was basically closed off. And a lot of the rest of the world didn't really know what was going on here. Seoul's only recently become a much more of a global city. So I've really seen the country change. I mean, there was periods where I would be the only Never mind me being white. The only guy who was not a Korean for sometimes a day or two, or you know, sometimes even a week at a time. Now you see a lot more foreigners coming down here, and so I think the country's adjusted quite nicely here. I've actually been asked this a lot because I think there's a belief that if you're in Korea, they're really going to like you if you're white and ask you to take photos with you. I think people get mixed up with something that's happening in rural China now. Occasionally, I found that people get confused when they're talking about China, Korea, or Japan. They'll hear something about one of the countries and then attribute it to the other one. I don't think anybody in Korea is particularly excited that I'm white. I think as far as dating goes out here, you'll find people that are interested in dating people who are not Koreans. There are also Koreans who absolutely only want to date Koreans. Question, have I found any personal hardship or joy? I mean, I've definitely dated some great people. I think, you know, overcoming some cultural barriers can always be interesting, but also really refreshing and enlightening as well. If you're going to come to Korea and you're interested in dating, I would recommend you learn as much Korean as possible and try to get as acquainted with the culture as much as possible. I mean, I feel like there's a whole other podcast you could have about this, but keep in mind that when you come here, like, for instance, let's take America, right? Anybody can be an American, right? If and that's what Americans actually believe, because the whole country is built off immigrants. In Korea, I don't think I will ever be viewed as a Korean. I will always be viewed with an element of foreignness, as much as I could speak Korean or know that. And there's pros and cons to that as well. I think there's different expectations for me. But look, coming out here, I would say you try to adapt as much as possible. This is a culture where if you're going to survive out here, whether it's dating or working, you need to assimilate as much as possible. I know there's parts of the world that you'll see expats working in where they can live in some kind of bubble and not really have to learn that much of the culture because so much of it's going to be catered towards their needs and what they want. I would say this is not one of those places. So if you're going to come out here, best to do a deep dive. I hope that's helpful. This question asks, have you had any recognition of your status from friends or family back home? Have you ever been recognized outside of Seoul or other tournament cities? Definitely when StarCraft II came out, I know there were a lot of people that went to my high school that played StarCraft that had no idea that I was out in Korea doing this. So I think a lot of my friends were shocked. This is back when I used Facebook, but a lot of people would message me on Facebook with surprise. As far as being recognized, I get recognized in Seoul, I guess, sort of a little bit, but I kind of have the best of both worlds with this because my show goes out to everywhere but Seoul, basically. Unless you're an expatriate living in Seoul and then you're watching my show. But I get recognized a lot more in airports or in the US or parts of Europe than I do actually down here, which I kind of like because I feel like I can keep to myself out here. Not that I mind being recognized, but it's kind of cool to do a show and live out here and then mostly get noticed when I'm overseas. But yeah, I mean, and I think I also got recognized by friends back home when I started casting a little bit of Heroes of the Storm way back when. This question asks, have I ever made any cultural mistakes or had to learn cultural lessons the hard way in Korea or elsewhere? And as an example, this person says, I wasn't prepared for the amount of drinking involved in some business dinners in China. So totally have I fucked up and had these totally awkward experiences. I think I had, oh God, there's so many just totally weird things I could tell you guys. Older Korean men occasionally will hold hands, much, much older Korean men. But I was once at this work dinner with these important older Koreans. This was like 9 or 10 years ago. And we were all sitting, it was like this restaurant where everybody sits on the floor and eats off tables low to the ground. And there was this guy, super important guy, and he was like almost halfway through his 70s or something. But he kept holding my hand while he was talking to me. And granted, I'm not homophobic or anything like that, but and a lot of Westerners don't realize that men just never touch palms of their hands together for extended periods of time. I mean, in other places in the world, this is more common, like the Middle East, or in this case, in Korea. The younger generation doesn't really do this as much, but I had this whole moment where I'm like, is this guy going to try to fuck me? Like, what is going on? I was so stressed. I was just like, this is so weird. And then after a little bit, I'm like, oh no, he's just, you know what I mean? Like, I thought, oh, okay, I get it. I didn't know it right then. I also, let me think here. What's some other ones I had? I was not used to the fact that Koreans talk about each other's appearances as much. In Western culture, you can have somebody that looks a certain way, and the odds of people just bringing it up out of nowhere, like people that you don't know that well, is pretty rare. Where in Korea, they'll just remark about each other, like, oh, you gained weight, or oh, you look good, or you lost weight. And so that took me a while to kind of recalibrate to. I had this one awkward interaction where I didn't understand that, because Korea is such a Confucian society, you have all these rankings. Like, for instance, in a U.S. company, you can go to a big U.S. company, and it's very hard to tell, first of all, who the CEO actually is, and then what the rank and file is from there, because Westerners are more comfortable trying to disguise that or make it more ambiguous because they feel like that's flaunting too much. Any Korean company or organization, you'll immediately be able to tell the rank and file of who's who. And so I made a mistake once where I was about to do a show, and the guy who was kind of in charge of me, he was going to go to a coffee shop, and I asked him, I gave him some money and said, can you buy me a coffee too? And that was like a cultural taboo because you're not supposed to ask somebody above you to get you coffee. So I had a whole bunch of weird moments like that. But, you know, you kind of go with the flow. I mean, after you, if you're going to move anywhere and get the hang of the culture, you kind of just have to be okay with it being awkward for a while, and then you'll eventually get the hang of it. This question asks, any music you listen to as a teenager that makes you cringe now? Well, I was a big fan of the Insane Clown Posse, as was my brother, ICP. It's no wonder that Tastosis is the Insane Clown Posse of esports now. I had a whole bunch of music to listen to. I actually don't even mind ICP that much still now, but I don't know, man. I mean, you know, when you listen to music at a certain age or in a certain phase, you know, your taste can kind of differ, but I love going back and listening to the old music I used to listen to in the day, like Korn. What else was there? I listened to The Offspring before they became bad. So like the first, like the Smash album, I loved a lot. But do I cringe to it? No, I don't really cringe about anything I did really as far as like artistic taste when I was younger, because that's just sort of where I was at and that's what led me to where I am now. Next question. How should a pro gamer, caster, or content creator know what he is worth and how much he can ask from teams or sponsors in brand deals? It goes on to ask, this kind of stuff is not something that many people are doing, and the few people that usually do it don't talk about how much they're making. For example, if I was an up-and-coming SE2 player, I would have no idea whether I would be in a position to ask a team for a small salary or if I should already be happy to even get travel support at all. And there's, it goes on to say, in parentheses, and get more, quote, exposure, unquote. And this person goes on to ask, and maybe as a player or caster, you can ask your colleagues, but I feel like as a YouTuber or streamer, it is even harder to judge. I remember Jeff mentioning on a podcast how once a game company wanted to pay him a certain amount to show off their new game. And when he mentioned the amount, it sounded like a great deal to me because it was quite above the hourly wage of a regular job. But then, to my surprise, Jeff went on to call the company inexperienced for thinking that he would do a sponsored stream for that little. I am a YouTuber myself, and I have shown off some indie games for free before, after the devs gave me free keys. And I have no idea at what point I would be big enough that I should ask for more, ask for more. Okay. So first of all, this is a great question. I think this is a question people don't ask enough of. Let's go big picture here. I might ramble a little bit. There's a lot to unpack here. So for one, you should always have the attitude that if you're good at anything, You should not do it for free. And you also, even if you love the thing, there's no shame in making money while you do it. So I love StarCraft. I love casting StarCraft. I love esports. I love gaming. The last 10 years, no, a little bit more than that, last 12 years of my life, every meal I've eaten, every beer I've drank, every taxi ride I've taken, every hotel I've stayed in that I was paying for is off of the money of my own passions. Okay, so I am living my best life here. A lot of people wish they could do that. So, and I'm bringing this up because I talk to a lot of people who feel like they're somehow they're selling out or they're being, I guess, just dishonest to themselves if they don't try to make money. And I got to tell those people, look, I mean, you can do what you love and make money doing it. So always focus in that direction. And this person, I think, already agrees with that. But there's a lot of people who haven't gotten past that crap. So the question you got to ask yourself is, do you have clout? How much clout do you have? If you think you have clout, you probably have clout. If you are, it goes to this next part of the question. It says, you know, some people will say you're going to get exposure for this. Okay. Well then ask yourself, how much exposure are you actually getting? Okay. If I had the opportunity, let's say I'm an actor. Let's take this out of esports. And I had the opportunity. Actually, I think I can do a real life example of this. Hey, Melty, can you look this up real fast? In Wolves of Wall Street, starring Leonardo DiCaprio, there's this comedian who's also in it. Without being crude, the chubbier guy, he was on like Pineapple Express. I think he's in a lot of Seth Rogen comedies. Okay, we actually paused the recording there for a second. We have the answer. So, Christopher Nolan film, Wolves of Wall Street. What the guy's name was Jonah Hill, right? Yeah. Great actor. He was paid only $60,000 for his role in this movie. Leonardo DiCaprio was paid $10 million, but also took a pay cut because he's normally paid $20 million. So, what's going on here, right? And just to get this out of the way as well, $60,000 for a movie of that size is not that much money. Keep in mind that it takes a while to film a movie, you know, and you're generally, when you're doing these filmings, you're not doing any other work. So Jonah Hill takes a pay cut for $60,000. Leonardo DiCaprio, and I mean, they were both, you know, the two main figures in the movie, okay? So it wasn't like this guy was an extra and Leonardo DiCaprio did the entire thing. I mean, there was a lot of scenes with Jonah Hill in it, but Jonah Hill looks at this and he says, okay, I need the exposure, so I'm going to take $60,000. I know that when we're hearing numbers like $60,000, you're like, probably, you know, your head hurts thinking like, because that's so much money. But even Leonardo DiCaprio took a half pay cut at $10 million. Now, he's financially fine, right? So he's trying to get Oscars. He's not worried about money. But, you know, Jonah Hill knows that he can end up winning. He can end up being in a movie that might win a major award, right? And catapult him from, you know, from being just a character in comedies to being in other types of films. So that's when he's willing to take a hit for exposure. So maybe you, you know, if you have some opportunity that you think is going to actually catapult your career, that's when you're really getting exposure. But a lot of companies will throw the word exposure around because they just don't want to pay you. I would say never do anything like that for a key. There should be some kind of monetary compensation. Because, I mean, this is how you make a living, right? I mean, they should give you a key anyways, right? Because that literally doesn't cost them anything, but you should 100% be asking for money. Now, I know that influencers, that's the term, by the way, influencers. So I'm an influencer, whoever this person is, I'm not going to say their name, but this person who sent this question is, they would be counted as an influencer. Influencers can make good money advertising games or promoting stuff. How much, I don't know because I don't know enough about your situation. But anybody who's not willing to pay you, that's a problem because there should be an advertising budget. Look, between Twitch and YouTube, most people find out about games from that. It's not from billboards. or going to GameStop or something and you know, having the GameStop guy come bother you about what game you should get. So for professional players, a lot of players do not ask for what they should be getting. This is very common. First of all, any tournament that's not willing to fly you somewhere, and you're a pro gamer worth anything, you should not be with those people. But anybody who's just not going to pay you at all, that's also a problem. I mean, you should be able to make money not just off prize winnings, because that's just, you know, frankly, kind of unstable. There's also problems, though, where, and this is a general problem in the industry, is that you have too many young people that just want to play their game and are not aware of what they should be paid. I've had my own agent, which was a terrible experience. I made way less money with the agency than I ever did on my own. I made more both before and after. So I don't know that there's a lot of good agencies out there just yet for the average pro gamer. So, you know, when you talk about influencers like Ninja, that person has, I would imagine, the exact right team around him to carry him forward. But if you're, you know, let's say, I don't know, you know, let's say you're a Mortal Kombat 11 pro gamer. I have no idea how much they're making. Probably not enough. I don't know what their travel situation is, but your travel should be covered. Your hotel room should be covered, unless the organizers are covering it or the publishers are covering it. And look, I mean, you always got to kind of push the envelope because, you know, no one's written a book about this. You know, the numbers are kind of all over the place in esports. I personally am just constantly experimenting with what I can get and what I can't get. And then I have to ask myself what's worth it for me. But if you do this correctly, you should be able to have enough money that it carries you. And from there, then you try to get, you know, creative and see how you can make more money turn into more money, basically. But until you make a certain amount, it's hard to make those decisions. And that's where a lot of people end up getting stuck. But look, I mean, those basic rules, they absolutely should be covering your travel. They should be compensating you in some way. Okay. And yeah, just anybody who tries to make you feel guilty or awkward when they're asking for money, I mean, that's just weird, you know. So yeah, I hope that advice is useful. The problem is, you know, it's different for each player and each person. And I hope that it was helpful. We can always do other AMAs down the road and stuff too, for people that have more questions about that as well. This question asks, how do you feel about the top heaviness of prize pools in certain esports? For example, the International in Dota giving $20 million away, but most other tournaments are in the game giving way less. So this is a marketing problem that's happening in esports. I get interviewed by a lot of news outlets. And one of the questions I'm always asked is, why does StarCraft II not have $20 million they're giving away? And look, Valve played their hand pretty correctly in this. I don't think it's good for the game, but it confuses a lot of people that really don't know what's going on in esports, because they see $20 million given away and they think, well, this is the game. Whereas what you're really doing is kind of creating this almost like Battle Royale Hunger Games for all the other Dota teams in the world. Right? I mean, it really should not be. This is where StarCraft II, I think, has done it right. Now, granted, individual player prize pools, that's a little bit easier to dice up. But, you know, there's a series of tournaments that happen in the year that players have the opportunity to make money off of. We also saw this with the $3 million that was given away for first place in Fortnite, who's, suddenly the player's name escapes me, but really talented young kid. All these, because, you know, $20 million, for instance, is such an insane number, it just draws the eyeballs of other news outlets. It gets a lot of attention. Is it healthy for the ecosystem? I don't know. But, you know, with all these games competing against each other, I think they're more interested in the short-term game and trying to see, you know, what they can do to stay ahead. But certainly there's a problem with ecosystems for pro gamers and how are they propped up. Now, that being said, I'm going to counter myself here just because I'm thinking out loud and point out that most other ecosystems that are similar or resemble esports in some way are insanely top heavy. If you take UFC, it's like a very small number of UFC people making a ton of money while everybody else is beating the shit out of each other and getting brain damaged and not getting that much. If you look at Broadway in New York, most of those actors are not making that much. There's a handful of high-class, sought-after actors who are making a good living. That is also true for acting as well. You know, you have like the Hollywood elite, and then you have a lot of people in Los Angeles working in restaurants and bars who are very good-looking, trying to score the next acting gig. You know, and on some level, this is true for casters. I would consider myself at the top of the heap of that. But, you know, for a lot of casters, it's hard for them to get by. And, I mean, there's a lot of casters out there now for a lot of different games. But I think having a correct ecosystem to sort of maintain that is important. We'll have to see. A lot of this is going to come down to publishers and how they incentivize this. It is a very easy mistake to make when you only reward the highest number of pros, because what you have is nothing underneath that, because you haven't incentivized anybody in the tier below the best to be training. So then you have a situation where a couple of these pro gamers retire or move on to another game or move on to whatever else. And then there's nothing to fill the gap. So I think it's a problem, but it's a conflict of marketing getting in the way of an ecosystem that's sustainable and long-term. And so we'll have to see where that goes. Again, you have a lot of different big companies here, all with their different approaches. They're all competing against each other. So time will tell. But I certainly, I think this person sees a problem. I do as well. I don't know if I have a great solution for that. Next question asks, I have been a fan and followed your casting since the first Brood War tournament. Then Artosis, Day 9, and In Control. I love the StarCraft scene, and with all that content, plus the group of people, plus that group of people, for so your group of friends have become part of my life. I have never met you, nor do I plan to. Do you experience fans that don't have boundaries, or that feel that they have a friendship with you, but you don't know this person? So, first of all, I'm really glad to know that I've had a good impact on your life. I really do this to like put something cool and fun out there. I love StarCraft. I love gaming, but it makes me really happy to know that I'm influencing other people. To this question, do I experience fans that don't have any sense of boundaries? Oh, yes. I have met some weird guys out there. Most people are fine, to be honest. I'd say like 99.9% of people that I meet are really cool. But totally I've met some people that, you know, usually it's like people that don't know that they need to leave you alone after a little bit. You know, I can even usually tell before it happens. I'll have like a nerd looking at me like he's a chimpanzee that hasn't eaten meat in weeks. You know, like he's giving me this kind of weird look. And, you know, this is also something that happens if you're a public figure, is you end up, and I don't want to, I love everybody who watches my stuff, but I've definitely had an experience of people that just, you know, kind of don't know boundaries, and they're usually harmless, you know, but sure. Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's unique to me. I know a lot of people in gaming and esports that have experienced that, but look, I mean, if you're anybody who's in the public, you know, you're going to end up meeting people that you would never normally meet. And, yeah, I mean, sure. It's definitely happened, man. But I guess that's kind of the nature of this job. And by the way, if you guys ever do see me in person, you guys can always come say hi. I do appreciate meeting people that watch my stuff. The next question asks, are you excited for the Final Fantasy VII remake? How about any other games? Okay, so first of all, I am totally excited about the Final Fantasy VII remake. I actually forget how old Final Fantasy VII really is, but I first saw Final Fantasy VII, I think, when I was in like fourth grade or something like that. And I was watching my friend's older brother play it. But this was basically the first game that was so much like a movie. It was so immersive. This is back when Japanese RPGs were much bigger than they are now. Yeah, I mean, that game, like a lot of people my age, that game had a huge impact on my life. And just so you guys understand, this was sort of, these games back then were kind of like Game of Thrones. Assuming that Game of Thrones never had that last season. But you know what I'm saying? It was like a big dramatic story, you know, it would take 60 to 100 hours to beat. And it looks like the modifications they made in the game are pretty good. Because a while back, I tried to show a friend of mine who had never played Final Fantasy VII. We downloaded a remastered version of it on Steam. And it was like, I forgot how unplayable it is now. because RPGs have become so much more advanced. But in this new Final Fantasy VII, they've definitely made it, and you guys can YouTube it. You'll see in the videos and stuff that they've kind of given it a combat system. The story was really good, so it's definitely going to be one that I'm going to be playing through. I look forward to it. As far as other games go, I mean, what is that game? Death Stranding, the new Hideo Kojima game. I've been a big Hideo Kojima fan for a long time. He made the Metal Gear Solid franchise before he was pushed out by Konami. But I just think that guy's a genius. The Metal Gear games growing up, Metal Gear Solid all the way through, Metal Gear Solid 5, were really like some of the most impactful story-based games ever. That really did merge like cinema and gaming together. So, yeah, I mean, I'm super stoked for that. But, yeah, other than that, I mean, no other specific games. Do I have any pre-cast rituals? I think I've talked about this a little bit in other podcasts, but, I mean, to get the obvious stuff out of the way, you know, watch games of players and, you know, be acquainted with the game. Basically, I find it's most important to be have a lot of energy ready, because it's a long broadcast, especially GSL broadcasts. That's sometimes up to 4 hours with almost no breaks. So I try to be in a really good mood. If I can work out before a broadcast, I will, or I'll go to a sauna and then go to these hot rooms and these cold tubs and alternate, because I find that kind of makes me more crisp. I mean, other than that, I do not like hearing bad news before a broadcast, because it just throws me off, because I'm trying to have fun with Dan. So I do know a lot of casters that take a lot of notes and do a lot of prep, and I actually am of the school of thought that that is not as helpful. I've seen casters write out long speeches and then fuck them up as the show starts, or have all these notes because they think the matchup's going to work this way, and the pro gamer, being, you know, the very, very head of his race in this matchup, does something crazy and unexpected because he's trying to throw off the other pro from the meta, and this person's notes do not align with that. I find the casts are best if they're done in an exploratory manner, where we're thinking and learning out loud. We don't go too hardcore, because there's people of all ranges of skill, new and old, that are coming there. And so I'm not as big of a note taker. If you guys see me on camera when I'm hosting stuff overseas and I have cue cards, a lot of times the information on that is so minimal. It'll have the name of the sponsors and the full name of what the venue's called and the city, just to make sure I say everything correctly. I'm trying to think of what else. I know Dan and me, we did some research in this a while ago, and whenever you go to a new casting station, we'll try to put our hands on the desk and feel everything, because that's supposed to give you a sense of ownership over the space. So we'll do that so it feels like it's ours. But I don't know. I mean, other than that, not that much. Just try to be in a good state of mind and a good attitude so you can have fun and be engaged. And I think if you're doing that, then the show is going to be fine. So there's a question here. There's actually been a couple of these sent in, so I'm just going to sum them up all at once. People are asking about the situation with my hands and my wrists and what's going on with that and how that's been affecting me as a caster. So for those of you that didn't know, I've been having problems with my hands and wrists for years now. I'll give the backstory here, basically, since we're doing this AMA. A long time ago, I had dislocated my knee in Azerbaijan. And I was in a cast for 4 months in my apartment. My apartment had no elevator. It was four flights of stairs up. So I was basically marooned in this apartment, unless I was casting, at my PC desk. And so in that process, I would just be there all day. I gained like 10 or 15 kilos. It was pretty terrible. And so in that whole process, I was just at my PC playing games, or, you know, clicking around, and I ended up getting an injury in my right hand. Now, it sucks, because when you get injured and then that causes another injury, you know, it's obviously very shitty, but my knee recovered fine. I can walk fine. I was told by the doctor it was a normal strain on my tendons. They did an x-ray. And they kept telling me, just lay off. It'll recover in a couple months. So I'd lay off. Then I'd come back. I'd play some StarCraft. My hand would flare up again. Lay off. Come back. And it got to the point where I couldn't really use my hand. And I remember calling friends and family going, I don't know what's going on. My right hand, it's not working. I went to another doctor. They did an x-ray. They said the same thing. So eventually, I used some connections. I went to the lead hand specialist. This is like, by the way, like over a year and a half into this, okay? Because I just kept taking these breaks. Things would calm down. I'd come back, and after a few hours of playing any game, my hand would go crazy. The hand specialist discovered that I had a very tiny microfracture in the bone of my right hand that occurred because when my knee was dislocated, I was clicking so much, I got what people normally get in the military when they're marching for days in their feet. It's called marching foot. I got that in my hand from clicking too much because I was just being a crippled guy in a chair at his computer for, months. So I had this tiny bone fracture in my hands. They put a cast on me. And if you guys go back and look at the StarCraft, what is it? It's one of the StarCraft 1 things I did with Jeff and Day 9 and Artosis. You'll see that I have this cast on my hand where like my two fingers, my middle finger and my index finger pointed out like a kind of a shape of a gun. And I had this cast on as StarCraft Remastered came out, which sucked because I wasn't able to play it all. So I did, I eventually after, I think it was 7 weeks, got that cast off, came back, started playing games, started using my hands after a couple weeks, because it takes a little bit for the muscles to grow back. And what I didn't realize is how much both of my hands had atrophied in this process. So as I came back, I then gave myself another injury in both my right and my left hands because I wasn't using my hands at all before this. So, there was this whole period where, eventually I was disabled and unable. I could barely use my phone or hold my phone at this point in time. So, I'm slowed down. I'm unable to do anything. The recovery wasn't happening. I went to another doctor, and they said the tendons in my hands had thinned out from lack of use. And I eventually opted to get this special treatment, which was a stem cell therapy, where they took stem cells from my fat. Actually, let me tell you this story. So I went to this special place. They said they could inject stem cells into my hands that would help it regrow. And then I have to do this sort of rehab program where I'm working my hands out, which I still do now. And so they said they'd take the stem cells from my fat. And then they would, I don't know how they do this. It's like some warlock shit. But then they take that and they put it in my hands. But what I didn't realize when I went in for the procedure was it's like a liposuction. They lipo some of my fat out. So I had to experience that, which is pretty unpleasant. And as they were doing that, I thought, fuck, I should have told them to take all my fat out if they're going to do this anyways. But anyways, they did that. They shot the stem cells in my hands. They gave me some PRP injections. And apparently when you get stem cell treatment, it takes months before it does anything. So after that happened, nothing was improved, and I was super depressed. And then the stem cells started growing. And guys, the last 2 weeks I've been playing StarCraft. It's been very exciting. Also very frustrating because I'm getting fucking owned, but it's been very good to be back. I'm being very careful. I've got like little braces and I'm doing my hand workouts. Here I am. It's been a while. Some of you guys are asking if that's impacted my ability to cast. Yeah, absolutely. This has been going on since a little bit before Legacy of the Void. It was affecting even like texting. I would have to lay my phone out on my desk. I'd have to have it so that the light always comes on if it's laid like down and stay on for a while. And then I'd text with the edges of my pinkies because it would hurt too much in my hands. Now I can grip stuff. It doesn't hurt if I turn a doorknob. I haven't gone into like weightlifting or anything like that. I'm kind of taking it easy, taking it slow. Basically, I just overused my hands. I went back to my normal hand usage, which was like riding bikes, weightlifting, playing games, texting, without fully realizing that I had a little atrophied bitch hands and forearms, and I needed to like grow them back. So I've been back. Jake's actually going to come over. I think next week we're going to be doing some drills for Zerg in StarCraft 2. And I've been trying to learn some Protoss here for StarCraft Remastered. I'm at like B rank right now. I think like 1850, 1860. I'm back. It's really good to be back. And so that's what's going on with that. So, again, very good to be back. I really felt like I was actually psychologically losing my mind in this process, too. I didn't realize how necessary it was for me to just, like, play StarCraft and play games in general and be active. It was so much better for my brain. So I'm in a very good spot. If you guys are listening to this, definitely do a lot of stretches. You can find videos on this stuff. I think my brother's got some great videos on this as well. But do stretches every day before you're playing and after. Be sure to do grip exercises. I use this one thing to work out where it's like a little, how do I explain this? It's like a ball I wind up and hold it. And then when I let go, it like I have to try to keep this gyroscope in the ball spinning. And it builds my forearm strength. But yeah, definitely take care of yourself because the RSI injuries are a real headache because it takes a long time to recover from them. And, you know, you use your hands for everything. We're going to do one more question. By the way, I tried to get all the questions answered. A lot of the people asking questions were sort of overlapping. So I hope we got them all. I'm actually down to do another AMA down the road, though. So this last question says, any interesting story about your heritage? Like, how did your family end up in the U.S.? So my last name is Plot. That is a Czech last name. My father's side of the family, it was two Czech. They were the gamesmen for the royal family, and they fled the Czech Republic. I think it was two brothers. They were on a boat. One of the brothers died. So we don't know if that was the Tasers or the Day 9 of that part of the Plot family at that time. But they came over to the Carolinas and North Carolina, settled there. And I think people do not know this at all about me, but if you look up Plot Balsam, that is the mountain that my family settled at. And they actually stole some of the royal family's dogs and bred them. And if you Google this, you can look up Plot Hound. That is my family's dog breed. And they are used for hunting, I think particularly hunting bears and boars. And so everything in that little area, it's like Plot Creek and Plot Road, everything's from that. And so that's a long history on my father's side from there. And there's still a bunch of plots over in that area. I haven't been back there for like a family reunion in like, dude, like 10 years or something like that. I'll eventually have to swing by. And from my mother's side of the family, let me see here. They were Irish immigrants. Well, my grandmother's side was in New York. My grandmother got a master's in chemistry back when women did not go to school, really, which is pretty badass. My grandfather was a pilot. Or he piloted airplanes and he fixed airplanes. And eventually, this is back when companies would like help you settle down. They settled down in Kansas City, which is why, and I guess at the time, that was a pretty nice place to kind of get a house at. And so there's some Irish there. And I think there's a couple other. I'm going to do one of those 23andMe things and figure out what my background makeup is. But because I know there's some German throat in there somewhere. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the story of my. I mean, you know, a lot of Irish people came over to the States and, you know, the famine. Ireland was not doing well back then. So there's, you know, obviously a ton of Irish people or people of Irish descent, I should say, in the States. And so I got a little bit of Western Europe and Eastern Europe in there. And I don't know. I guess that's some cool tidbits for you guys. And I guess this does it for the AMA. I'm going to close this out. Thanks for sending these questions in, guys. I didn't realize you guys were going to send in so many good questions. Let's do this again sometime down the road. We've got some other awesome guests coming up here on the Tasteless Podcast. They're going to be announced soon. And we are not stopping. We are going to keep going. I'm loving doing this, and I love you guys. I'm making this for people like you. If you can support us, we really appreciate it. If not, no problem. But if you can, please go to patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. And that is the easiest way to support me and what we're doing here as we continue to try to make this show more awesome. I hope you guys have an awesome week. We'll be back again soon. Take care of yourselves. This podcast was produced by Melty, artwork by Alarise, music by Mark Lentz. This AMA was brought to you by you beautiful bitches who supported me on Patreon. Bye-bye.